friends, new or regular listeners, thank you for tuning in to the program. My name is Henrik Palmgren and this is Red Ice Creations Radio. We are recording from Sweden in Scandinavia, and you can find us worldwide at redicecreations.com. News, radio archives, films, links and resources. And we've got an excellent program for you lined up, so let's tune in. Today we are joined by filmmaker and researcher David Cerida. Some of you might be familiar with some of the films that he's behind, like Evidence, The Case for NASA UFOs, From Here to Andromeda, and his latest one is called The Voice. There is a few different websites that you can take a look at during our program here today. voiceentertainment.net, From Here to Andromeda.com, and there's also waterthemovie.com. David also has a blog that you can find at davidcerida.blogspot.com. So I'm looking forward to talking more about some of David's film work and research here today. So it's a pleasure to have you on the program, David Cerida. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Henrik, for having me on and to be in Sweden. And to talk a little bit to Europe will be fun.
Excellent. Thank you again for coming on. You know, I thought we could begin today to talk, if you will, a little bit about your background for listeners that might be not be familiar with you, your films, or your research. And I must say that you seem very well versed in many different scientific fields, but also in various spiritual teachings. Do you have a background in any of these fields, David?
Well, my background is in the arts and the ecology. I actually started studying photography, and I won a lot of awards in photography in school, and then I became a tree planter in the mountains of British Columbia in Canada. I'm Canadian by birth. And I planted trees, you know, for about 22 years. I planted trees in the forests of British Columbia all the way up into the Alaskan Panhandle. And in the off-season, which is about 6 months of the year, I was making films and writing books and researching and practicing meditation every single day now for over 30 years. Mm. I'm 46 years old. And, you know, when you meditate every single day for 30 years, you're bound to have some very profound experiences. And some of the periods of my life, I was meditating 3 to 4 hours every single day for many, many years. Mm. And now that I'm very busy, I sit, you know, maybe an hour per day in sitting practice. And I've done a lot of different therapies, and I've studied with a lot of different masters from the Far East, just dozens of them, and I've traveled to India, taken the Dalai Lama's course, 7-day course, and I've, you know, studied with different teachers in India. So I've been exploring consciousness, studying world religions and the space sciences. I'm very well known for my research into UFOs and the UFO interstellar phenomenon, and my first film was called Evidence, The Case for NASA UFOs, which was a really low-budget film I did with my friend John Johnston, and we made it for just about $3,000, and it's gotten, you know, over 1 million downloads on Google and YouTube before I took it off.
Yeah, wow.
And, you know, it became kind of a cult hit film, and what I wanted to do with it is just make $1 downloads, and, you know, it's just, it's insane what's going on with Google and YouTube. That nobody pays for the content.
Sure.
But in order for me to continue on as a filmmaker, you know, I have to charge even a nominal fee for some of these films per view.
Right.
And I just haven't been able to set that up yet. But my new film, The Voice, explores... I'm approaching the problem, are we alone in the universe, from a different perspective. I'm looking at the physics and the research that's being done into consciousness and the conscious universe. Mm-hmm. And once you can identify how the conscious universe works, the idea of contacting extraterrestrials or life beyond Earth gets a little more exciting than just sending radio waves around like we're doing now and searching for a signal. I mean, just recently, the Beatles song Across the Universe, inspired by John Lennon, was inspired by his visit to India, studying under Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Mm-hmm. The song gets broadcast, I think it was on February 4th at 7 p.m., you know, New York time. And the Maharishi dies within, you know, less than 12 hours. He died.
Mm.
And I thought that was pretty amazing. I mean, it's like this beautiful song about, you know, a guru, the guru of Maharishi, is being broadcast across the universe to the North Star, and he dies just in time to, you know, catch the wave.
Exactly,
when you think of music going all the way out into the universe like that, I mean, Pythagoras, the great Greek mathematician and the father of modern music and classical music, experienced going beyond the physical body's boundaries in a very purified state of consciousness and hearing the music of all the nine planets. And he coined the term the music of the spheres.
Right.
He invents the monochord, and then he actually develops the intervallic system that leads to modern, you know, classical and modern music. Well, those I started having experiences like that, and I didn't know any history or anything about it. My father, you know, took me to, he led a Buddhist meditation retreat in our house in British Columbia in Vancouver in the early 1980s, and I was about 17, 18 years old at the time. And after sitting in meditation pose for 12 hours a day, which is, you know, I've done extreme skiing, skydiving, tree planting, you know, riding my racing bike 35 miles a day up and down mountains. And the hardest thing you can possibly do is sit still all day and holding a posture, you know, not just sitting in a chair, but holding this cross-legged posture. And every hour you get up, you stretch your legs, and then you sit again. And facing the opaqueness and the boredom of the mind is excruciatingly difficult. But finally, on the second day, I just had this explosion of ecstasy that started in my belly center, and I just started laughing, and I had to excuse myself from the room, and I went into this cosmic state of mind where I was walking in my body, but I wasn't the body. I felt like I was this giant field, and the field, I could feel when the wind blew through the trees, it was like it was blowing through me, and I would laugh because I would say, oh my God, the wind is touching me, but it's the tree. And when the birds walked on the grass, they were walking on me, and there was this ecstasy bathing everything in nature. I looked up at the sun, and I heard this sound. I heard the sound of the sun. It was a really deep, low hum combined with a very high-frequency ringing sound. And I stood there looking at the sun going, oh my God, I'm really hearing this thing. I'm really hearing the sun. And for years, my friends would laugh and say how crazy I was that the sun isn't making any noise. And, you know, over 20 years later, NASA has now recorded the sound of the sun, which we have this whole section in the film The Voice, this three-hour high-definition documentary on consciousness. And, you know, you can actually hear the sound of the sun and experience it. And it's exactly as Pythagoras had described it in the 6th century B.C., that the high and the low sound combine. So the film, The Voice, explores everything from the auras of subatomic particles, the auras of atoms, to the auras of humans and plants and plant consciousness researchers, all the way to the Global Consciousness Project at Princeton University, where we see the aura of the planet itself being measured in the lab, and all the way to the what are known as the nine greater rings of enlightenment, which are have different labels and names in different religions, but they are all extant in most of the major religions of the world. And the idea is that, for example, nirvana, and it's a very common term. A lot of people hear the word nirvana, and they know the rock and roll band, and Buddha attained nirvana. But what they don't know is that nirvana is the culmination of Buddha having spent, according to reincarnation theory in Buddhism, 400 lifetimes perfecting six levels of these rings of consciousness, of enlightenment. So when you go into a state of consciousness that extends all the way through the nine planets, these are like giant belts or rings of awareness, which scientists are actually measuring today in the lab. Now, the idea that you can merge with those fields means that when you enter these fields, you become all-knowing. You get to know what the fields know, how, you know, what they actually have recorded throughout history, what they know. You can know the truth about anything. And the fields just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And Buddha says in what's known as the Lankavatara Sutra, a paramount sutra to Tibetan Buddhism, that you're not in nirvana until you cross the seventh. And the seventh is the only permanent realization. All the other states beneath it, a practitioner will go in the state and get, you know, very, very incredibly high and knowledgeable and gain all this insight and wisdom, and then they'll go back to normal human suffering. But once you cross the seventh, you're permanently enlightened, and that is the idea of a truly enlightened master, someone who crosses the seventh. I had an experience after 7 years of meditating every day. This was in 1986 at around Christmas time, where I was taken through all seven, but I didn't cross the seventh. I only came to the border of it. And these states are spectacular. I mean, it's unimaginable. We think of, you know, space exploration and science and the idea of, you know, all of the conspiracies on the planet that are trying to create, you know, like your films, mind control.
Right.
And the only ultimate freedom is to free your mind, you know, like in the movie The Matrix. The only real thing you can do is free your mind, and the question is, how do you do it?
Right.
How does consciousness become a victim of what I call the polarity matrix field?
Mm-hmm.
And how does it attain true liberation? That's what the movie The Voice is about. We interview scientists, experts, people of all walks of life who are, you know, experiencing mystical states of consciousness, practicing different types of meditation, or sometimes just spontaneously these experiences occur to them, from small children to, you know, people of all different walks of life, and we kind of, you know, merge science and what theory in different religion tells us about these experiences, and
mm-hmm.
of course, ultimately, how anybody can start to have these experiences. And when you consider the number of people that are suffering from depression, severe depression today, you know, literally in the hundreds of millions worldwide,
right.
A million suicides per year worldwide, we know that people, you know, the economy and the way the world governments are designing global economies are making it harder and harder to own a home anywhere on the planet.
Right.
You know, I mean, I know from my brother who lives in Sweden, I mean, the taxes are so high in Europe.
Yeah.
And even though some of the real estate is cheaper, the taxes are way higher. And here, our homes are all like $1 million, $2 million in our major cities, and they become untouchable.
Yeah.
And so how do you find enlightenment? How do you find freedom? And, you know, in my studies, you know, in extraterrestrial life and the films I've made on UFOs, from Evidence the Case for NASA UFOs to Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs and to my 4-hour miniseries From Here to Andromeda, you know, to me the UFO represents freedom of movement, the idea that if you can possess this technology, you can go anywhere you want in the universe, find your own planet, and not be forced to pay enormous taxes. And the idea that a piece of land has to cost so much money, just this little piece of dirt, you owe your life just to live on it.
Sure.
You know, you got to work your ass off day and night just to stay on this little piece of dirt.
So is David, is this what it's about, so to speak? I mean, in regards to attaining higher consciousness, could this also be because with higher consciousness you can actually develop new technology? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I really believe that. Yeah, I believe the Einsteins, the Teslas, you know, many of the greatest scientists of our time experience these expanded states of consciousness. I mean, one of the things we explore in The Voice are a lot of Einstein's great sayings, but also the one thing in physics that mystified him more than anything was spooky action at a distance.
Right.
He experienced that living things, like a mother and a baby rabbit, are separated by, you know, hundreds or thousands of miles, and you hook them up to EEGs, and electroencephalograms, and their brain waves are being measured, and you pinprick the baby rabbit, and the mother responds instantaneously, not at the speed of light, which would be talking on our cell phones, you know, because microwaves are traveling at the speed of light, but instantly faster than the speed of light. And then a French physicist named Alain Aspect separated an electron-anti-electron pair, known as the positron, separated them by thousands of miles. I don't even know how they did this, but when they stimulate the wave properties of one, the other responds instantaneously. And it turns out that water does the same thing. You can take water that was formerly a glass of water, separate the water into two pitchers, and then expose information to one pitcher of water, and regardless of distance, the other one responds instantly. So what it means is there is something conscious in water, in hydrogen. There is something in spooky action at a distance that shows us how we can circumvent the speed of light limit, and there's a way to communicate instantaneously anywhere in the universe. And this starts to get into the problem of we don't see anything in real time anywhere, not even in front of our face, meaning the speed, we see everything at the speed of light, which is not instantaneous. It's mm-hmm. moving at 186,282 miles per second. That's not instant.
Right.
So when we look at Andromeda, it's 2.2 million light years from here. We're seeing as it was 2.2 million years ago.
The past,
Yeah, we're seeing the past. Even our own sun, we're seeing it in the past. So spooky action at a distance gives us a clue of where the real-time universe is, and it turns out that consciousness, especially a particular type of consciousness, knows exactly what's going on in the real-time universe. So you think of the Matrix, and you think of coming out of the Matrix, how all of the ancient Hindus called the world the Maya, the illusion.
Right.
And you think of the beginning of the movie The Matrix, you see Keanu Reeves opens this little box and it says Simulation and Simulacra, which was a book written by Baudelaire. A really incredible book, which really shows us how we fabricate our Maya, our illusion. We create a web and a trap to bind ourselves to. And the economy, the economic trap, and the economics of trying to sustain ourselves and our lifestyles is so overburdening, people don't have the time to think about consciousness. They don't have the time to meditate 3 hours a day like I did for 30 years, because their goal is to pay for that house, is to pay for the mortgage and the car and the fuel and the wife and the kids. And it used to be sustainable. I remember, because I was born in 1961, that my parents bought a house for $20,000 and you could pay your mortgage off in about 10 years.
Right.
And now, with one person working, with only the husband working, my mother took care of us and she made clothes for us and we had this great lifestyle, and my stepfather was a science teacher. And then you see today it takes two people to barely make it work, just so you have just enough. So what society is telling us, they don't want us to be free of the Matrix. They want to bind us to total slavery.
Yeah.
So films like From Here to Andromeda challenge that, and the idea that if we attain this technology, because I'm going to go back to your question here, do we gain knowledge by going into these fields of awareness, and
right.
do we get the answers? Well, it turns out that most of the people, like Einstein, who, rode his bike around Princeton University, was a massive genius, he spent all of his time in meditation and deep thought on how the universe was working. And I really believe he went into these super expanded states of consciousness, and so did Nikola Tesla, and there's many, many great thinkers throughout history, all over Europe and the Americas. And what you find is the people who changed the world, the man who invents the light bulb and the motion picture, Edison, these people were in states of meditation that were so profound that in these states they have these epiphanies or revelations.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they get them is they go into these, nine greater rings of consciousness. Anybody who pierces the seventh would be, historically, anybody who crosses the seventh becomes fully realized, and their aura is so luminous and so powerful. It's really hard to miss it.
Well, David,
the Dalai Lama tells us that he is not enlightened by the Buddhist definition. He has not attained nirvana, but that doesn't mean he doesn't go into some of the greater super expanded states of consciousness, the six lower rings of enlightenment beneath that.
Mm-hmm.
Because nirvana crosses the seventh and eventually goes into the eighth and the ninth, which I give this spectacular tour of these rings of awareness in the film The Voice.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, when you look at conspiracy theories, you look at how much we're being oppressed, the ultimate thing that people can do is learn how to meditate every single day. And I guarantee you, no drugs, you sit there and you do this practice like I've been doing every day, within just a few years. I started having super mystical experiences in the first year that I was practicing. And having traveled to India and all these different places, I've designed a series of meditation lessons One called Deep Relaxation Meditation, one called Insight Meditation Level 1, which there'll be a Level 2 and a 3. And then I'm going to be teaching people the deeper levels of meditation called Singularity. And then I have 7 Energy Centers Breathing Meditation. And they're only $5 as downloads on voiceentertainment.net /store. So, you know, I'm making this stuff really cheap for people. It's like, you know, it's the cost of a beer at a bar. You know, you can get a meditation lesson from somebody who has been doing it for 30 years and has translated all the Greek and foreign terminologies and, you know, made it very simple for Europeans and Americans. So.
Right, because there's so many different practices to kind of go through. And have you kind of developed your own, or have you kind of picked and choose by, you know, those who are out there? How did you do it?
Well, what I did is, having attended many intensive, you know, yoga learning processes, therapy, emotional release, and different types of sitting meditation, there's all these different techniques from the Far East, and I found that a lot of the terminologies and, you know, people, when they start learning all these different Sanskrit terms in India, and, you know, these things, they have a certain sacredness to them, to their culture, but the pure state of mind, you don't need to learn any of these terminologies. You just need to learn the core practice.
Right.
Arthur C. Clarke, the science fiction writer, said the world's perfect religion would be purified Buddhism. That means the practice of Buddhism purified of all of the terminologies in the foreign languages, just the core practice. And one of the things that happened to me is, in the very beginning, like that experience I had in my dad's retreat, it was my first intensive, and in a way I was very innocent and I think it was 1982 or 81 when I did that retreat.
Mm-hmm.
I think I might have been 20 years old when I come to think of it. And I didn't have my mind bogged down by all these books that I read about meditation. I just sat there and I did this simple practice, and I had this enormous experience. But what happens is, when people become very knowledgeable and they have all these terms and all these ideas floating around their brain, it makes it hard to meditate.
Yeah.
Because you become attached to, you know, the different terms and different stages of meditations and all these different mantras and prayers.
Right,
and
right.
You find that ultimately meditation is about you. It's not about worshiping any guru. It's about knowing your own self in God consciousness, or you can just call it the field. You don't even have to name it. The universe's intelligence ultimately is way beyond name and form.
Mm.
So the meditations I've designed are like Arthur C. Clarke said, they are purified Buddhism, Hinduism, mystic Christianity. They're very simple, but they're very deep and they're very effective.
Mm.
And I found that there was a lot of terminologies and ideas about non-attachment and attachment, and you have to do this if you want to get to this state. And I found that a lot of those were mistranslated from the Buddhist and Hindu into English, and can be disastrous if a person goes down the wrong road.
Mm-hmm.
For example, non-attachment is not really, it doesn't mean you push everything away in your life and you become this aloof person. It actually means the opposite. It means non-attachment in Buddhism is neither clinging nor aversion. You experience everything. Completely human in every way, but with the awareness that everything is constantly changing. And therefore, no matter how profound of a blissful experience you may have or a painful experience you have, you experience it with the awareness that this is going to pass, it's changing. So your non-attachment is more, it's not about pushing anything away in your life. It's
right.
Experiencing everything with awareness.
Right, because yeah, exactly, because many people actually... they try to, you know, radically change their life in that way, that they're, okay, now I shouldn't be, you know, materialistic, all, you know, all stuff is evil, basically, and they push that away. But again, this is not at all about what is going on in the external world, because this is only an internal thing, and you can still live a life as a normal, you know, regular human being, but still have an internal peace and knowledge about what is going on in the world, right?
You know, you're exactly right. Like, the thing about materialism is really tricky, because if we say, I'm going to become anti-materialistic, then you're going to push everything away, and I'm going to be like living in a cave or a simple apartment.
Right.
But you now become attached to that, and you're pushing something away, which is creating what's called a polarity field matrix. It creates a duality. And dualities in meditation, we realize, they waste all of our energy. All seven of our chakras are energy centers in our body, from the base of the spine. And these energy centers, I'll describe them very quickly, but you don't even have to believe in them, and you really know they're there. We have our sex center at the base of our spine, and our sex center goes into conflict about sexuality, who we're attracted to, am I going to be rejected by this person or accepted by them, am I going to allow this feeling to exist in my body or not. That's the conflict that goes on in the sex chakra. The next energy center is where your belly button is, and this is where we were connected to our mother's womb for 9 months and our father's energy. That is our life force. That's where we feel either connected to life or rejected by it. And we have dialogues about the conflict of, you know, am I accepted in this social situation or am I rejected? So that center wastes all of its energy in conflicts of that nature. And then the third center is where our adrenal glands are in our liver. It's in the, you know, right in the beneath the rib cage in the sternum. That is our adrenal, our motivator energy center. So this is where we feel either engaged or motivated to do something, or we feel passive, like, no, I don't really want to do that, or if I start this business, someone else is going to go to business and they're going to compete with me. That's where our motivation energy center is.
Right.
The next one is the heart. We either feel loved or we feel rejected. We either feel connected in the heart center to a person, family, community, or the world, or the universe, or we feel rejected by it. And the idea of rejection and acceptance itself is a waste of energy. And then we go into the throat, which is, of course, where we communicate. Our vocal cords are there. And then above that is the space between the eyebrows, is where we visualize all of our stimulus. This is where our visions take place, in our mind's eye. And the top of the head is the universal connector center. So what's amazing in the film The Voice is a Russian scientist named Konstantin Korotkov, who had a near-death experience. He has several PhDs in physics. He developed the world's first three-dimensional human aura imaging camera and software. It can take a picture of your entire auric field, but not just for a visual Kirlian photography effect. He can actually measure the information coming out of the light waves from your, what are called our biophotons. Biophotons were discovered by a German scientist named Fritz Albert Popp in 1974. He proved their existence in 1976 and that they were coming from the DNA.
Right.
So our DNA is transmitting light, and that light has information. It has your memories, your consciousness, your thoughts, and that information gets shared in the collective field of the universe, in the actual atoms that are surrounding our bodies, in our bodies, and throughout the universe. These atoms are actually recording and storing all the information that's being transmitted off of all living things. So now that Popp measured the existence of biophotons and their information, Konstantin Korotkov's camera can read the information in your auric field. And this is very useful. What we did in the film The Voice, we showed five meditators, all of our seven energy centers. The machine can actually see how much energy is coming out of your heart center, how much is coming out of your belly, your sex center, your universal connector center. And it was amazing to measure our chakras before and after meditation. And some of the meditations were 45 minutes, 1 hour. Some of them were half an hour. Some of them were almost 3 hours. But you'd see this enormous increase in energy coming out of the energy centers, which you can really feel. Like, you don't really need the machine because you're really feeling it, but it's amazing to see that it's really there.
Right, right.
It's not your imagination. And so this camera, the effects of the camera, it's on, The Voice is it's a three-hour kind of miniseries. It's in about the first 45 minutes of the first DVD. Of part one, people will start to see this machine that I'm talking about.
Very interesting.
So again, what we're doing in Voice Entertainment with our films is we're exploring the conscious universe. You may have heard of a film called What the Bleep Do We Know?
Right, right.
The co-producer, co-director of The Bleep, Betsy Chase, has joined partnership with us. and we're releasing our films together with them.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a film called Water, which was made in Russia. You might have heard about it in Sweden. I'm not sure if you've heard of Water. It demonstrates the power of human consciousness with relationship to water. And it's documented by Nobel Prize-winning physicists and physicists from, you know, the Austrian Institute of Physics, and, you know, physicists and scientists from all over the world internationally have come to this consensus that water has memory. It can record information in history.
Right,
it can record everything.
That kind of suggests also the idea of homeopathy, right?
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly. The idea, you see, homeopathy is vibrational medicine. And so you think of the idea that if you put vibration in medicine, the vibration of a particular plant or herb or medicine into the homeopathic remedy, that it's the vibration or structure of that plant or that remedy that's really going to heal you,
right?
Not necessarily the chemistry. But also radionics healing works a very similar way. A radionics doctor will take a sample of your blood, and they will send vibrations, particular healing vibrations, into your blood, and at a distance, regardless of where you are on the planet,
mm-hmm.
your blood will respond to those vibrations.
Hmm.
And that could be very dangerous, too, because it could be used in a really horrible way. Someone could take a sample of your blood, and which is your personal DNA, and they could be doing voodoo to it. So it's not something that it's a great power that you don't want to really mess with.
Well, it's like with all things. I mean, you could use it for good or for bad, and it's a flip side on all of these things. I guess the important thing is to know that this is real, because then you actually have the knowledge and the you know, in the intention that you know that this can be used either for good or for bad, and if we're aware of it, that's the first place to begin, you know?
Yeah, it's the first place to begin. I mean, understanding that, like, for example, in the beginning of The Voice, the first thing I do is I ask, to me, this is the ultimate question. Scientists are describing the Big Bang, the first, you know, trillionth of a second, billionth of a second, all the way down to the first second, and they're describing what's happening in creation. All the way down to, you know, 15 billion years later or so, which is where we are today. And they're describing the birth of the universe as if somebody's watching.
Hmm.
And there's a famous Zen koan that says, if a tree falls in the forest and there's nobody there to see it fall, did it really fall? Well,
right.
If you don't have an observer consciousness, you don't have the event. And the idea that organic life on our planet wasn't, you know, our planet's over 4.5 billion years old, and that, you know, life evolved, you know, no more than a few hundred thousand years ago at this point, you know, human life. And you think, you know, if there was no organic life form in the universe, and according to very, you know, staunch conservative scientists, you don't have an observer. So if nobody's watching the Big Bang, it's not happening. But now when you think of the idea that water can scientifically be verified to have memory, consciousness, and that hydrogen, which is the H in H2O, was present about 1,000 seconds after the Big Bang. It only took 1,000 seconds for the universe to start to create structures, hydrogen, that can store information or self-reflect or therefore be self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
The universe, it seems as soon as you have hydrogen, is self-aware, but it's possible that consciousness existed even before that. And the idea that, you know, when you look at Einstein's spooky action at a distance and you see instantaneous propagation of thought or information, and you think of the speed of light limit being amazingly slow in the size of our galaxy, let alone the universe, it means there's an actual verifiable force there that is probably consciousness. And I think that is what caused Einstein to say that anyone who gets involved in the field of scientific research at this particular level, he states, you know, in his own words, that they become convinced that a spirit vastly superior to that of man is present in the universe.
Yeah. Hmm.
And I think it was action at a distance that caused him to say that.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, action at a distance violated the speed of light limit and most of what Einstein set forth in his theory of relativity. It was the one thing that baffled him to no end, but I think it was the thing that made him become sort of a spiritual thinker.
Very interesting. You know, there's so many things there that I kind of want to pick up on. And one thing, of course, that is very interesting in regards to water that you mentioned, excuse me, is because in your film, Evidence the Case for NASA UFOs, you detail a little bit about these phenomena with water coming into the planet. And what, you know, kind of I began to think about here right away was that could this be in a way that signify that kind of a new consciousness is coming into the planet, or is this occurring all the time? Have you had any thoughts about this after you made the film and after you made this discovery?
Well, Water was a film made by Russian producer Saida Medvedeva, which my company is distributing with the Bleep people, and they're also distributing The Voice. They have watertheMovie.com and TheVoiceDVD.com is our relationship with them.
Right.
But okay. I know what you're talking about. You're talking about in Evidence the Case for NASA UFOs, you have the University of Iowa, Lewis A. Frank, who's one of the principal investigators on many of our satellite missions to the various planets. He's the one that discovered that only on the ultraviolet-sensitive cameras, still cameras, on some of the satellites, he noticed these giant balls of water were coming in from outer space. And I got into these incredible dialogues with him about, well, how would water survive the intense solar radiation? Wouldn't it just burn up before it even got into the atmosphere?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you're right. But what was interesting about this particular type of water is that it was only showing up in the invisible ultraviolet. So that means you have mass, you have hydrogen and oxygen, water, but it's invisible, which means it must be vibrating in a higher frequency of you know, actual mass at a higher frequency, and that's a subject that very, very few people even talk about in physics.
Right.
The idea that mass can go ultra-high frequency or interdimensional. Now, not anything physical, a gas, liquid, or solid, you should be able to see with ordinary sunlight, but these balls of water didn't show up. And they could clearly see them impacting the upper atmosphere and producing these 100-mile-wide vapor clouds in the upper atmosphere and transferring, you know, oxygen and hydrogen into the upper atmosphere. And there, when you think of the idea that consciousness may be in these droplets of water, there could be a transference. There could be something happening that we can't even conceive of yet. And Lewis A. Frank's observations were laughed at by a lot of mainstream scientists, but he was convinced they were there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sent him videotapes from space shuttle missions that also had the ability to see into the ultraviolet, you know, these black and white video cameras.
Right.
And you see these impactors coming in from outer space. And he wrote me back that he was convinced that these might be the same things he was seeing on the still photographic cameras on these different satellites.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the end of our conversation. And he said his researchers were fascinated by the NASA photography that I sent him.
Mm.
And that was kind of the end of it. You know, he really didn't want to get into the subject of UFOs too much.
Right.
But when you look at the size of some of these objects that show up on these, you know, these invisible light video cameras on NASA's cameras, you know, some of these things are two, three miles wide,
yeah,
as we demonstrated. And that is the idea, and you can see these waves, these spiraling geometry waveforms pulsing out of them, which when we slow the waves down, you can see are the, you know, the traditional Fibonacci spiral waveform.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, well, what if these things are strobing the planet with consciousness, with information?
Right.
And what is that information doing? You know, are these like gods, these giant fields that are 3 miles wide, and these fields are emitting consciousness? I mean, it becomes really incredible when you really think of the idea that, you know, we want an extraterrestrial to arrive in an ocean liner and step out and have arms and legs, but what if they're just fields that are invisible to most humans, but these fields are showing up on these video cameras, and they're transmitters of intelligence.
Well, I mean, as you kind of elaborate on in the film Evidence the Case for NASA UFOs, you mentioned that idea again about you know, going into higher frequency, and this enables you to, you know, travel faster, basically. And I guess the question there that arises, okay, so how do you go, you know, into that higher frequency state, and how do you go back from it? And what we might be seeing there is something that still is in the higher frequency range. Even ET or, you know, some other intelligent being might actually live in this field, but not be able to, you know, go back into our, you know, frequency field. I have no idea. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, I really think a lot about what you just said. I mean, that is my whole theory, is that, you know, when I saw a UFO, a metallic spaceship right in front of my eyes when I was 7 years old in Berkeley, California in 1968, after 20 minutes of a crowd of people watching, and the thing just went invisible in a blink of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
And think if you were a fish and you were underneath, you know, one of the great oceans or lakes, you know, in Sweden, and you're under the water and you're with another fish next to you, and your buddy fish gets caught by a fishing line and he goes flying out of the water. You look up, and as far as you're concerned, the top of the water is the top of your universe.
Right.
And as soon as he leaves the top of the water, he's invisible.
Yep.
You don't know where he went, but he's actually in another dimension right above you called air mass.
Yeah.
But you can't see him. Once he goes a few feet above the surface of the water, he's invisible. And that's how I see these UFOs. They go invisible by changing their vibration, their frequency of all the molecular and atomic structures in their spaceship and in the pilot, the actual extraterrestrial's body.
Mm.
And so when they go into a higher frequency, they just simply disappear from our view. It doesn't mean they don't exist, they're just not here.
Right, right.
And I've come to the conclusion that these super advanced extraterrestrials are not moving like an ocean liner moves through an ocean. They're not moving through the fabric of space itself. They jump out of space just like the fish jumped out of the water.
Right.
That's why we don't see them, you know, coming like here they are, they're coming by Venus. And, you know, they're going to be here an X amount of time, and we can estimate the time of their arrival because they're going at this speed. All of a sudden, they just pop in our atmosphere, and then they hang out for a while, and they're gone.
Yeah.
They don't, you know, and they can zip around. Once they lower themselves to our dimension, they can, you know, zip around the planet for a while, and then they just pop out.
Hmm.
And the digital camera, you know, with the advent of all these little digital cameras everyone's buying, people are taking pictures on their vacations, and, you know, above a lake or, you know, right above, I know this one above the waters around Fiji, this ultraviolet-colored disc-shaped flying saucer just appears in the middle of the frame.
Hmm.
And they didn't see it when they took the picture. And I have several examples of this in from here to Andromeda. And you can really see this. So you're starting to get scientific proof that they're really here. They're just not visible to the naked eye.
Mm-hmm.
And I really became fascinated by the invisible when, after meditating for many, many, many years, I had, in 1994, and I've said this on many radio shows, so it's not so shocking, but Jesus Christ appeared to me, and I was Buddhist, hardcore Buddhist. He appeared in this blaze of light, a thousand suns, you know, brightness. I fell upon my face, and he began teaching me mystic Christianity and the teachings of singularity, non-dualism, which is a very, very deep subject. I ended up finding out that everything Jesus said to me was extant in the non-canonized Gnostic Gospels,
mm-hmm.
and even some of the canonized Christian Gospels, that his teachings on non-dualism were synonymous with the teachings on non-dualism and Buddhism. Nirvana is the ultimate non-dualistic state of consciousness, and what the Hindus call Advaita Vedanta. And I started to realize that consciousness must have been trapped in duality, because when we see ultimately with the experiments on water and many other experiments in quantum physics, for example, David Bohm's implicate order, he, with these furious dialogues he had with an East Indian mystic named Krishnamurti.
Right, right. I remember seeing that, yeah.
Right, who was trying to tell him the observer is the observed. Bohm actually finds out that the only place you could see evidence that the observer consciousness is the observed is on the quantum level, meaning the quantity of the atom and smaller, which is the study of quantum physics, that you could see that thought was shaping and affecting subatomic structures.
Mm.
And that was what was going on in water with Masaru Emoto's experiments, also the crystalline structures of water.
Right.
So when you consider the idea that consciousness is the authority on matter, and that matter, when you look at what atoms are, they're polarity matrices. You have a proton and an electron, positive and negative, right?
Mm.
And then when you look at the proton is made up of proton-antiproton, which is another dual matrix, and the electron is made up of a positron-electron pair, and that's a dual matrix. And then when you go into the neutron and the proton, you find this is where all the quarks are, and they're all dual-paired. And then you see the tau, anti-tau, the muon, and the anti-muon. It doesn't matter how far down the rabbit hole you go in the subatomic universe, everything is in duality.
Right, right.
And that's because it's a reflection of consciousness. Then you go back to the Garden of Eden concept that God warns us, never take in this knowledge of good and evil, for in the day you do, you will surely die. Well, it turns out that what is the whole thing? What is good and evil? The whole thing. It's a conflict. So if we originally existed in singularity, non-dualism, and we take in the knowledge of good and evil, we radiate conflict. And the irony of the knowledge of good and evil is that it's a riddle that you try to solve, and everyone throughout history tries to egoically identify good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is it's always different than your neighbor. Even your best friend will see the same thing differently than you do. And then we get into arguments. We say, no, it's this way. And you say, no, it's not that way. It's this way.
Right.
Or my interpretation of what Jesus or Buddha or Krishna said or Radha or Hanuman, or it doesn't matter who you're talking about,
right,
is this way. And yours is that way? You mean you don't see it the same way that I do? And then, see, that's what the knowledge of good and evil does. It's a conflict. And it causes consciousness to go into a conflict.
Yep.
And consciousness tries to egoically identify good and evil. My religion is right and yours is wrong. Or my interpretation of my religion is right and yours is wrong. So you, just like in Ireland, you have the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, and you have the Catholics and the Protestants bombing each other on the streets.
Right.
Every religion divides, and has hundreds of different schools because nobody agrees.
And yet, David, I just want to interject there, yet I see that the world as it is today is based on the duality. I mean, everything, as you said, in nature is based on a duality. We have the winter, we have summer, et cetera, but it feels like the singularity that you're talking about is more like the source, and if we look at Garden of Eden as a symbolic event, that's more like us or consciousness going out from the singularity and kind of entering into the material world of duality. And right now I don't know if we want to say that we're stuck here or not, but are you saying or suggesting that we should return to the singularity, or what do you mean?
I'm saying that it's actually an amazing thing to be in the dual universe, but
right,
it's only useful to be here if we can non-egoically identify with our concepts of God-isms and religions egoically in opposition to the other. Saying, for example, my daughter is Catholic and she cannot marry a Protestant, but she falls in love with a Protestant because she does, love knows no boundaries. You see what I mean?
Right.
We waste, what I have discovered in meditation, and this is in my meditation lessons, is when Jesus said, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light,
mm-hmm,
Matthew 6:22.
Yeah.
And then in the Gospel of Thomas, there's over 20 references to dualism and singularity, and how Jesus attained all of his miracles was by canceling out the two and making them one.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look in the Gospel of Philip, Jesus says, right after the famous kiss with Mary Magdalene, in this world there is good and evil. Its good things are not good, and its evil things not evil. He's not saying that murder and death is not evil. He's saying that the polarity matrix of good and evil is, there's something above that. There's something beyond that, and it's called singularity.
Mm.
And so what I see is, by taking in the knowledge of good and evil, all of our seven energy centers are in a state of conflict. The conflict is wasting all of our psychic energy. And if we can end the conflict and attain peace in every one of our seven energy centers, we go into a harmonic. And when we go into this harmonic, and I've experienced this, after years and years of practicing meditation, the harmonic of all the seven energy centers causes the aura to go from its normal 2 feet beyond the body and start to merge with these 9 greater rings.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go into these 9 greater rings, you don't just get unbelievable ecstasy. I mean, I have experienced levels of ecstasy in these fields that are torrential, that bring you to your knees and crying your eyes out in love, but they give you intelligence, the intelligence of the universe. So it's not like you're just dumbed out in bliss. You actually have access to anything you want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I experienced this in the presence of Jesus Christ 3 times in person. He took me through a total
David,
of...
I just want to ask you there. How come that you identified this person as Jesus? What did he say that to you, or how come you did that?
Yes. It's very, very clear. And I know there's these theories out there that Jesus never existed, and they're really poorly researched. I mean, I've read massive volumes of ancient Roman history and early Jewish history and Christian history, and the arguments that suggest that Jesus never existed are so poorly researched, and they're so delusional that I could sit down with Timothy Freke, who wrote the Jesus Mysteries, and just tear him to pieces. I mean, he doesn't even know what he's talking about. He's making references to Jesus and Dionysius, and Dionysius is the Greek god of wine, and because Jesus turned the sea into wine, he's just a spin-off on Dionysius. And,
right.
You know, what happens is this. It's not a coincidence that Socrates was poisoned, that Jesus was crucified, and Jesus didn't invent crucifixion. It's something that existed in the Roman Empire and the Byzantinian empires and even the Egyptian empires thousands of years before Christ. So the idea that we keep torturing and killing our super enlightened masters it doesn't mean it's the same story being retold. It means we keep killing our masters.
Right.
It's not evidence for saying Jesus never existed. What I experienced, and I was, baptized Catholic as a baby, but my father taught me yoga, meditation, Buddhism, Hindu gurus, and I love all of them to this day. I'm a mystic Christian today, and it's because when I saw Jesus, I have never, ever seen a being anywhere near that magnitude of glory and enlightenment in all of my life and all of the different teachers I've met, including many out of body.
Okay.
As soon as I met Jesus, I had the ability to see invisible beings with my own eyes, and I've seen hundreds and hundreds of invisible beings, some historical figures, some beings just from other worlds, and I don't see them in my mind's eye. I don't intuit them. I wake up in the middle of the night, and they're right there. They're glowing with light, or they're not, and they're just hovering right in front of me. I've even seen my own dog when she's dreaming, and she's floating around the room. And this is what happens is when you start to expand your consciousness and you see the idea that digital cameras are picking up orbs of light and ghosts and UFOs, you find out that what we perceive of the visible universe is really just a sliver of reality.
Right.
That if you expand your consciousness, you can start to see these invisible dimensions, which the Buddha spoke about, Jesus spoke about, and Krishna spoke about, and all these many, many great teachers, men and women alike from different religions. And when you're seeing it, you know you're not crazy. I'm really seeing this. I'm really seeing this person who is deceased right in front of me. But this is where I became fascinated by the invisible, is when I started having these experiences. I wanted to prove it. And in the film The Voice, we interview Roger Nelson, the head of the Global Consciousness Project at Princeton University, Robert Thurman, professor on Buddhism and Far Eastern Studies at Columbia College, New York, Gary Schwartz, a Harvard-Yale professor who has one of the most advanced consciousness studies labs in America at the University of Arizona at Tucson, is a firm believer in the invisible. In fact, they have new cameras now that they are testing a lot of different psychics on to see where these apparitions are taking place. Are they taking place in the infrared or in the ultraviolet? And they're actually going to get to the point that they're going to be able to see them.
Wow, very fascinating. Hey, David, we need to begin to round things up here for our first segment, and we can continue talking about this and much more in our next segment. But before we finish off here, though, I want to leave the last few minutes, excuse me, to you, so you can mention how people that are interested in getting either your latest movie, The Voice, or From Here to Andromeda, or the other one, how they can go about doing that, getting your film, that is.
Well, the easiest way to get The Voice is go to thevoicedvd.com. If you want to get From Here to Andromeda. It's from here to andromeda.com. And on my website at voiceentertainment.net, you can get The Voice. You can get my meditation lessons. I have a weekly podcast radio show there for members. And my meditation lessons are only $5 as MP3 downloads, so they're very, very affordable. And my new film, which I haven't even told you about, is coming out in the middle of this month, Mona Lisa's Little Secret. In the middle of filming The Voice, I have decoded the Mona Lisa. I had this amazing spiritual experience, and that film is almost done. The book, Mona Lisa's Little Secret, is also almost done.
Right. Wow, that sounds fascinating. Let's talk about a little bit about that in the next segment. But, David, for this segment, thank you very much for coming on. We're going to take a little break right here, but we'll speak more on the other end. David Sarita and I will continue our discussion in our members section. We're also going to talk more about The Invisible, David's take on 2012, and Da Vinci's Mona Lisa. We'll also address the Bloodlines issue related to the Da Vinci Code, David's upcoming film projects, and much more. So don't miss our second segment with David Sarita. If you want to have access to our members section, it's easy. From our front page, redicecreations.com, click on subscribe and set up a subscription, and you'll get instant access to our entire radio archive going back to April of 2006, where we have some brilliant discussion with many of our guests. You'll also get access to our short films and commentary articles. This is an excellent resource if you want to go deeper into the subjects we cover on the program. Thank you for listening, and my thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren. We will be back on Thursday. Not to forget, live Red Ice Creations Radio is on the horizon. Until next time, all the best. This is Henrik Palmgren. We'll talk soon.